From the Denker studio on Library Square, this is The Rundown, an exploration of local news, current events, and issues that matter to you. I'm Roger McDonough. Coming up today on the program, we're going to be speaking with Dr. J. Craig Venter, who is probably best known for his work sequencing the human genome. Dr. Venter will be in town tomorrow night to give a Natural History Museum of Utah lecture. A pioneer in the field of synthetic genomics, Dr. Venter will talk, among other things, about the concept of designing new life forms.
The future will have new genes that didn't evolve from natural evolution, and they'll have new combinations of genes in genomes that did not evolve from natural evolution. Most of the components will be from pre-existing, pre-evolved gene elements, but in combinations never seen before.
That and your local headlines just ahead on The Rundown here on KCPW. And thanks once more for tuning into The Rundown this afternoon. A little bit later on the show, we'll be speaking with Dr. J. Craig Venter about new developments in the field of synthetic biology and his lecture tomorrow evening, part of the Natural History Museum of Utah's Pushing the Boundaries of Life lecture series. But right now, we have these local headlines. Former Utah Attorney General Mark Shurtleff says an investigation into his involvement in a jailed businessman's case years ago was one-sided. Shurtleff said in a statement Wednesday that the investigation released Tuesday by Attorney General Sean Reyes was based on lies from a convicted felon. Shurtleff said he did not speak to those investigators because of a separate ongoing criminal probe by two Utah County attorneys into Shurtleff and his successor, John Swallow. Both men have denied wrongdoing. The report released Tuesday focused on claims from businessman Mark Jensen that the fraud case against him dating back to 2005 was prejudiced. Investigators said there's no evidence Jensen suffered, but faulted Shurtleff for allowing, quote, back-channel talks with Jensen. Shurtleff says he's eager for the day when he can, quote, fully set the record straight. Now that spring weather is upon us, many Utahns have momentarily forgotten about the nasty effects of the winter inversion. But the Salt Lake City Council wants to make sure the issue stays on the agenda. That's why on Tuesday, the council invited an air quality fact-finding panel to the weekly work session. The assembled group of council members, experts, and policymakers convened to discuss the state of air quality in Utah. KCPW's Ryan Cunningham has this report.
On Tuesday, Salt Lake City Council members Luke Garrett and Aaron Mendenhall invited a host of experts to discuss how the city can best address air quality issues. It was a broad topic to broach, but the council found a number of avenues to explore. They began by peppering Brian Roberts of the city attorney's office with questions on how the city can use its jurisdiction to set rules on air quality. In reference to wood burning, Mendenhall wondered if public health couldn't be regulated under public safety in the fire code.
Health is certainly a core component of the code.
Mortality seems to be the
That's really what drives it is, how do we prevent buildings from burning down? And if they do burn down, how do we get the people out? That's really what the fire code is primarily concerned with.
Bryce Bird, the director of the Utah Department of Environmental Quality, perhaps got grilled more than anyone else on the panel. In particular, council members prodded Bird on why industry emissions were so difficult to regulate. Bird explained that industrial facilities can't be brought to new standards until the state has worked with the businesses to update their technology. Attempting to understand this policy, Mendenhall used an old, beat-up truck as a metaphor for outdated facilities.
Is it kind of like if we came in with a 67 pickup truck and it's just stinky and coughing out terrible stuff, that as a regulator you couldn't say, I'm sorry, you just have to buy a new truck. We'd have to keep coming up with technologies to try to make this old truck fit into the round hole.
Yes, that is the Clean Air Act authority that we have.
Wood burning came up frequently during the meeting, and some council members seemed hopeful that the Salt Lake County Health Department's board might have the authority to set limits on how and when wood is burned. Corbin Anderson of the county's health department noted that the county is trying to work with the health boards of neighboring counties on air quality issues.
So we've pulled together the other county health departments, and we've agreed to approach any local regulation development on a uniform basis. So we have an equal playing field across the whole area that's in non-attainment.
But when pressed by Mendenhall about whether the County Board of Health had enough information to legislate on wood burning, Anderson seemed to suggest his board did not.
Is there a sufficient amount of health information, local public health information related to air quality, that would be sufficient for more strict regulation of wood burning seasonally?
I would say that we are getting closer on having ample information. I think we've gotten more in this past year than we had the previous 10 years leading up to that.
Vicki Bennett of the city's Public Services Department talked about some of the initiatives her department has been working on, but she mentioned that the city is dependent on other local entities to regulate air quality issues.
We are really dependent upon state law and then also partnering with the county as our county health department for any meaningful regulations at this point in time. As you remember, Mayor Becker did have his 5 requests that he made of the legislature to ask to improve air quality, and it was everything from increased funding for transit, gas taxes, the Tier 3 gasoline, allowing us to be able to have stricter laws and building codes being improved for air quality issues. And, you know, unfortunately, none of those passed in, you know, any clear form.
Mendenhall and Garrett hope to have another panel discussion on air quality later this year. For KCPW News, I'm Ryan Cunningham.
And finally today, Utah State Parks will hold a reopening celebration next month at Willard Bay State Park's North Marina, which has been closed since a fuel spill last year. Officials say the May 24th event at the Northern Utah Park will run from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. and include music, food, and educational booths. Earlier this year, state officials approved a $5.35 million settlement with Chevron over the pipeline leak, which released about 20,000 gallons of diesel fuel. Utah officials say that in addition to cleanup after the spill, the park has received new wildlife habitat, restored nature trails, and additional parking. The park, which is located 12 miles northwest of Ogden, is one of the state's busiest, attracting about 350,000 visitors last year. And that does it for our summary of the day's local headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and you're listening to The Rundown. We'll be right back. And now on The Rundown, we're going to turn to a conversation with Dr. J. Craig Venter in advance of his Natural History Museum of Utah lecture tomorrow night at Kingsbury Hall on the campus of the University of Utah. Dr. Venter is perhaps best known for sequencing the human genome a decade before most thought it could be done. He's the founder of the J. Craig Venter Institute, a not-for-profit organization dedicated to genomic research, and he's also the founder and CEO of Synthetic Genomics Inc., or SGI, a private company involved in commercializing advances in genomics. Venter is the author of the books A Life Decoded, My Genome, My Life, and Life at the Speed of Light, From the Double Helix to the Dawn of Digital Life, which is the subject of his lecture tomorrow night. He joins us now by phone from his offices in San Diego. Dr. Venter, thanks for taking the time to speak with us today.
My pleasure to be with you.
For those of us who did study things like public policy, art history, or comparative literature, what does it actually mean to sequence a genome? It's essentially putting all that information into digital form?
Well, when you sequence, the term sequence, the sequence, the order of the A, C's, G's, and T's determine everything in our bodies and every other species on the planet, much in the way the order of the ones and zeros in the computer determine everything you see in the computer. So the computer code is just ones and zeros. Our code is a little bit more complex because we have 4 elements, A, C, G, and T. But getting the exact order of the 6 billion letters in our genetic code is important for understanding which parts code for proteins, which parts are regulatory functions, how the combinations of these work to create unique cellular functions, cellular structures, and then the more complex structures with the combination of our 100 trillion cells. So when we read the genetic code, the key thing is getting the precise order and combinations of the A's, G's, and T's across all of our chromosomes. So it's not a small task.
Okay, great. Well, that's a perfect foundation for the rest of this interview. Moving on, a new age of digital biology. Variations of that phrase have been used by the reviewers of your book, Life at the Speed of Light, which delves into the cutting edge of the world of synthetic biology. To get a sense of the book and of the field, I want to read from the closing of the introduction to your book. As the industrial age is drawing to a close, we are witnessing the dawn of an era of biological design. Humankind is about to enter a new phase of evolution. I was wondering if you could give us a primer on what is sparking or what sparked that new phase.
Well, for quite a while, and it'll be the topic of my lecture there tomorrow, is we've been reading the genetic code. Did the first genome in 1995, and then the first human genome in 2000. And when we read the genetic code, I call it digitizing biology, because we're converting the A, C, G, and T chemical code into the ones and zeros of the computer code. Once it's in the computer, we've found we can go the other way, and that's what the big advance was in 2010, when we started with the digital code in the computer, and a synthesis machine that actually writes the genetic code, starting with four bottles of chemicals. So we recreated the entire genome of a bacteria, 1.1 million letters of genetic code, with some design changes, and found a way to do a chromosome transplant where we could boot that up in a cell and create a cell totally controlled by that synthetic, chemically made genome. Once that happened, it sort of proves that the rest is possible as we learn how to do design, because it proves we can actually do the construction.
Yeah, you talk about going in the other direction by starting with the computerized digital code, designing essentially a new form of life, chemically synthesizing its DNA, and then booting it up to produce the actual organism. Are we talking about designing entirely new organisms, new species with little relevance to the evolutionary tree of life, or what is the actual potential and ability here?
Well, everything going forward will certainly depend on what has evolved over the last close to 4 billion years.
Of course.
We can, in fact, create new genes. We've been working on a program to convert sugar into the chemical that goes into plastic bottles. Right now, that just comes from oil. No natural enzymes exist to do take part in that transformation. So we work by writing the genetic code and making thousands of versions of it until we basically created a new enzyme that we could select that does the key step in that process. So the future will have new genes that didn't evolve from natural evolution, and they'll have new combinations of genes in genomes that did not evolve from natural evolution. Most of the components, you know, we've just from our ocean expedition have discovered close to 100 million genes, will be from pre-existing, pre-evolved gene elements, but in combinations never seen before.
You know, you mentioned the idea of, now I can't remember what it was, but something for the design of the plastic bottle. I'm wondering about other potential. What is the promise of these designed organisms? What other practical uses are we talking about?
Well, synthetic genomics, we've been working on lots of different applications of the technology. For example, we have a cell that produces large amounts of omega-3 fatty acids that's going into scale-up production. We're working on new synthetic vaccines. So the latest flu outbreak of a very dangerous flu strain, H7N9, developed in China. It's been spreading there. It's in Hong Kong. The first case has not yet occurred in the United States. But based on the first cases in China, from sequencing that genome and decoding it, we use that genetic code then to build a synthetic vaccine that Novartis, working with the U.S. government, has now scaled up to create stockpiles for the first time before there's ever a single case in the U.S. So using the synthetic DNA, we actually have a vaccine ready if H7N9 outbreaks start to occur in the U.S. So that's a change in history, a change in evolution, and that's one of the future potentials for this technology.
And it's also a change in ability. I mean, part of this has to do with the reason for the title of your book, Life at the Speed of Light. Maybe you could explain the potential of sending sequenced genes digitally and what that, I mean, I guess you kind of touched on that right now with the idea of the vaccine, but what else does that mean for us?
Well, once the genetic code exists as the one and zero digital code in the computer, we can actually send that through the internet. We can send that as electromagnetic wave at the speed of light. I use the illustration in the book of if we had a DNA sequence from a robotic device sampling on Mars,
right.
It could send that sequence back to a lab here in San Diego in as little as 4.3 minutes, in contrast to getting a big enough rocket up there that could blast off from Mars and get back to the U.S. That round trip would take months and cost billions of dollars. So being able to send life through the internet and recreate it at the other end is a change in our thinking about life, our thinking about the inner conversion of it, and the ability, for example, to distribute a new flu vaccine around the entire globe in a fraction of a second.
To some extent, parts of this might sound a little bit frightening to some people who are listening. And I'm wondering if there are unseen dangers lurking here, or what are the risks of this kind of work? Some talk about new life forms being, you know, becoming invasive species or being weaponized. Do you see, I mean, how do you account for, what do you think of that kind of talk of risks?
Well, it's important, and it's important to be aware of potential risk from people abusing any technology. You can build a home or a hospital with a hammer, or you can kill somebody with a hammer. All technology has a dual risk profile, and so when there's really new radical technology, it becomes something that people become, you know, they first think of all the dangers, which is probably smart. But I think while the Obama Bioethics Commission reviewed that and came up with some ideas and recommendations for tracking it, they also came to the conclusion that this technology is so powerful with its ability to change the future of life for the positive that the decision was made, or the recommendations were made, not to overly regulate it or shut it down at this stage. There's not a lot different between in the outcome of a new emerging infection or a man-made infection. We have to have vaccines and antivirals and antimicrobials to treat those. A far bigger danger right now on the planet is new emerging infections. If we can solve those, we eliminate the bioterror threat as well.
How about, I mean, you touched on this, the sort of ethical standpoint. Where do you see this work? Some people would argue that there are just some areas that ought to be left alone entirely. You know, the boundary between life and what is alive and what isn't alive is discussed. What are your thoughts on ethics, aside from the risks, on the ethics of this kind of work?
Well, the first third of the book discusses the history of thinking in this entire area, going back to Aristotle. And it turns out people have been thinking about synthetic life forms far before even the fundamental science of the cell was understood. And just people thinking about the philosophy of life that, of course, sometime in the future, synthetic life will happen to prove that life is made up of chemical components that can be recreated. A French author that I referred to wrote a book over 100 years ago saying when it eventually happens, people shouldn't even be surprised because it's so obvious. So that thinking on one hand versus, we have a large contingency that is relatively ignorant about science and the principles of science in our country. A recent survey showed that over 50% of people don't know that tomatoes have DNA. Every species on our planet is a DNA-driven species. But if people don't even understand that basic level, that tomatoes totally exist because they derive from a genetic code, a genetic software system, it's kind of hard to have a more intelligent conversation about the risk versus the benefits.
And you can imagine that ignorance can lead to fear and so on and so forth. 50%, though, that's a remarkable statistic, Dr. Venter.
Yeah, and then the other thing to look at is the 1918 flu virus killed 3% of the population of our planet. And so to me, being able to eliminate that risk completely seems like a pretty positive benefit to humanity. you know, it's bizarre when to me when people advocate that we shouldn't have medical advances and we should go back to the dark ages where there were no antibiotics and half of children died from infectious disease before reaching maturity. That doesn't sound like a good approach to life to me.
Hey, you know, you talk about, actually, before I ask that question, I'm curious, how far has this gone in terms of, I mean, you synthesized, you talked about being able to transplant synthetic DNA for a bacterium into a host cell. Has this gone beyond that? Are we able to create larger synthetic organisms?
Well, it hasn't been done yet. It's theoretically possible going forward. We're doing things based on, you know, principle and need. The bacterial world is going to be the world that drives the engine for food production, for chemical production, for cleaning up waste and water for the future. You know, creating an artificial cow might be interesting scientifically, but there's not a lot of practical use for that, let alone the experiments to go beyond it. A group recently published, instead of making a synthetic chromosome the way we did from four bottles of chemicals, they made small segments of the yeast chromosome synthetically and replaced them one at a time. I liken it to if you want to rebuild a brick building, you remove one brick at a time and replace it with a new brick. If you did that, eventually you'll end up with a new building with new bricks. So it's a clever technique, and that was done. And so one of the multitude of yeast chromosomes was recreated and redesigned using the replacing a brick at a time approach. So that opens the avenue for making multiple changes in more complex eukaryotic organisms as an alternate to what we're doing, where we're synthesizing the entire chromosome ourselves.
This is my last question, because I'm taking up quite a bit of your time, but there's kind of a Frankenstein question here, which is, at what point in that replacement process does the organism itself become something different than what it is? I mean, we talk about speciation too, but in the actual definition of the thing, kind of a maybe more of a philosophical question, actually.
Well, no, it's an important question of how we define species. Before science advanced, you know, when Darwin was sailing around describing all the unique species in the Galapagos, for example, he did it and recorded them by writing down the description of what he saw and sketching sketches of what the species looked like and, where possible, killing and preserving a sample. So the world has been sort of defined by what we see with our eyes. You don't see the genetic code, you see the end result of that. But the superficial nature of species sort of belies the incredible degree of complexity in the genetic code, right, that we share with all other species. So depends whether you're describing the species by what it looks like or by what its complex genome is describing its degree of functions as. So both are important in descriptions, but the genetic code tells you several orders of magnitude more about a species. And once you start making changes in the genetic code, technically it's a variant of that species.
Well, and you are, it's a bit more precise than describing traits and saying this thing has these feathers. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. Among many other things, Dr. J. Craig Venter is the author of Life at the Speed of Light, From the Double Helix to the Dawn of Digital Life. He'll be speaking tomorrow night at Kingsbury Hall as part of the Natural History Museum of Utah's Pushing the Boundaries of Life lecture series. Dr. Venter, thank you for taking the time to speak with us today.
Okay, well, and thank you for your excellent questions. You clearly thought about this, and that makes it more enjoyable, so thank you.
Thanks very much. And I'll mention quickly that tickets to Dr. Venter's lecture tomorrow night are still available by visiting kingsburyhall.utah.edu. KCPW will also be live streaming that event as well. I'm Roger McDonough. You're tuned into The Rundown. We'll be right back. And thanks once more for tuning into The Rundown here on KCPW. Our show was produced by Lauren Colucci. We had additional help from Jesse Ellis, Ryan Cunningham, and Mr. Tyler Ford. Our theme music was composed by Tim Myers. Tune in each weekday at 5 for an exploration of local news, events, and issues that matter to you. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for listening. The Utah Business Report and Marketplace are coming up next.